Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 31st, 2005. This is your host, Stephen Novella, President of the New England Skeptical Society. And with me today, as always, is Bob Novella.
Hello.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
We're going to dispense with science or fiction this week and get right to our special guest. This week we have with us Dr. Robert Park, who is a professor of physics and the former chair of the Department of Physics at the University of Maryland. He currently divides his time between teaching, and he informed me just recently that tomorrow, I guess, is the first day of the academic year for him. And he also mans the Washington, D.C. office of the American Physical Society, which he himself opened in 1982. And the reason why he's on our program is because Bob Park is the author of the book Voodoo Science, The Road from Foolishness to Fraud, and is very well written in the areas of pseudoscience and is an advocate and very active in teaching science to the public. Bob, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So just to get started, a new poll was out today. This is a Pew poll. This is nothing new. I'm sure everyone here has heard this before.
I saw the results of that, yes.
Yeah, so it says 64% of Americans, when asked, prefer that creationism be taught alongside evolution in public school systems.
64%?
64%. The poll also asked the questions of, do you endorse evolution? Do you endorse creationism? And to what degree? And 42% of the respondents described themselves as strict creationists, basically living things have existed in their present form since the beginning of time. 48% said that there was belief in some type of evolution, although, you know, typically, you know, half of those people believe that evolution was guided by a supreme being. Those numbers have been pretty steady for the last 20, 30 years, depending on exactly how you phrase the question. But with this type of poll, it's been just about 48% believe in some type of evolution, less than half. And, of course, now almost two-thirds believe that creationism should be taught alongside evolution. So this is a pretty good marker of what we perceive of as a failure of science education in America, or do you think this is more of just a cultural phenomenon? What do you think is the meaning of this, Bob?
Well, it certainly is a little discouraging. However, on a question like that, Americans are so concerned about fairness always.
Mm-hmm.
That when the question is asked that way, I'm sure their feeling is, well, everybody should have a say in this country.
Now, I agree. I do think that creationists historically have played upon people's democratic sensibilities, and very successfully. They just want fair play. And you have to understand that intelligent design or creationism in any form is not science. And I think that is the point that most people miss. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, I think that's right, and the trouble is, it all depends on the way the question is asked.
Right.
In the account I saw of that, I didn't see exactly what was asked of these people.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on the way the question is asked, you can get a very different answer.
That's right.
We did one with the Kansas City Star a few years ago, in which they had done a poll on how old people thought the universe was, and when they asked them if they agreed with the Genesis account, and of course almost everybody said yes, they agreed with the Genesis account. So we asked them to try the poll again, which they agreed to do, and they did, but instead of asking it that way, they simply asked them, do you believe that there were dinosaurs on the Earth billions of years before humans were on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everybody thought there were.
Right, right.
So it was, again, just the way you asked the question, that people are very reluctant to identify themselves as being anti-religion in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it reveals the bias of the questioner, of the pollster, at least to some degree. Because,
well,
you know, their biases.
Asking the questions the right way is certainly an art that many polls don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, did you say that this way? What was that? A PU poll? What was it?
Pew.
Oh, Pew. Okay.
PEW. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it does depend on how you ask the question. It might not, even if it doesn't reflect the bias of the surveyor, it could just represent an artifact of poor question asking. Often, it's helpful, I would think, to ask the question in multiple different ways. And when polls do right. that, it often becomes clear that the numbers don't add up, that somebody, at least somebody, people in the poll had to give contradictory answers, which always adds a certain uncertainty to the numbers. But I think you can compare a poll to itself over time, and those numbers have been stable over 20, 30 years, which I think is one interesting thing we could say about it. And consistently less than half, rather than saying that they don't believe in religion, I think it's consistently less than half, or around 48% of people endorse evolution in any form. So I still think that's it's discouraging, even if you shed some doubt on the numbers because of the way the questions were asked.
Either way, we've got a lot to do.
So it's an uphill battle, and it's incredible that Darwin, first postulated this idea, 150 years ago, and the majority of people have yet to accept it, even though the vast majority of scientists, by the estimates that I've read, I don't know if you've read the same thing, about 98% of scientists with a relevant expertise in the natural sciences agree with evolutionary theory.
Well, and in fact, my recollection is that at the time that that Darwin came out with that, the leading biologist in the mm-hmm. world was Thomas Huxley. Mm-hmm. And when Huxley was asked, what he thought about that, his reply was simply, "Why didn't I think of that?" And I think most people have that sort of reaction, how with something so powerful and yet so clear, how could it be that there was it took that long to be discovered?
And then T.H. Huxley became his most ardent advocate, so-called Darwin's bulldog, and many credit him with basically the tipping point in within the scientific community of evolution becoming more broadly accepted. I believe it was his famous confrontation with a creationist at the time. Wilberforce?
Yes.
Bishop Wilberforce. Yeah,
Wilberforce.
I've read accounts of that confrontation that was described as the tipping point for the acceptance of evolution. And since then, it's essentially been accepted by a majority of the scientific community. And of course, that was, that was in the 19th century. So there remains a huge gap between what scientists believe and what the public believes. And I think that to a degree, you could say that perhaps that's cultural, but it seems to me that that's a failure of science popularists and science education. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, in my opinion.
What's troubling here is that if we take this historical view, almost everything we know about the world, the universe, has been learned almost within a single human lifetime. That's really astounding. So it's mm-hmm. not surprising, really, that the acceptance of this is far from complete.
I find it interesting that the public seems to have embraced a scientific figure like Albert Einstein with great fondness and affection and appreciation, yet a scientist like Darwin, who arguably was of his equal in the 19th century, is vilified largely by a lot of people. I find that very interesting.
Well, because Einstein didn't strike a nerve the way Darwin struck a nerve. Treating people as mere animals. That's very that's a very sensitive area in people's psychology, and that's the reason, Evan, why I think that's so. Who cares about traveling close to the speed of light and gravitational effects? It's interesting, but
it's a little abstract for the common man. Yeah. Just on a related topic, I just noticed on your website, which I'll mention as bobpark.com, it's an excellent website. You have a section there called What's New, which is a great place to go to get the latest dope on these types of topics. Number one on the list for August 26th, which is the date that comes up when I pull it up, is that Senate leader Bill Frist has sided with President Bush on favoring the teaching of intelligent design in the science classroom.
It just got worse, in fact. Senator McCain has also chimed in.
Who?
That's unfortunate.
Senator McCain.
That's unfortunate.
Oh, that's right.
He just, that's the center of the Republican Party, as opposed to the far right or religious right. Well, McCain also, he disappointed on the Terry Schiavo case as well. I think when cases like this comes up, he plays to the party's core.
Well, we know who's running for president now, at any rate, in both cases.
But. Absolutely. But I think what this underscores is that there's a huge political dimension to this topic as well, and politics and science never mix. It's always a disaster. You can't subjugate, in my opinion, science, which needs to be a free and open inquiry, basically following logic and evidence wherever it leads, to a political agenda. I mean, the classic example of that is Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union, where the genetics program was essentially handed over to a Lamarckian, and that became the state science. You know, the politicians basically decided what was the official science.
And they still haven't recovered from that. I mean, it set them back that far.
It put them back like 30 years, and they're still behind the rest of the world, the Western world, in the fields of genetics. That's the fear, is that in areas like stem cell research and natural sciences, that America may lose ground to England and European countries and now even countries in Asia, and we may never really regain the lead.
You don't think America has the capability to catch up if it does see the light, Steve, and eventually snap itself into place?
It's hard to say. There's such a cultural dimension to science. I mean, for the Germans have been the best chemists in the world for 300 years, 400 years. They still are. Why is that? How could they maintain that kind of expertise in a narrow field like that for centuries?
It must be,
I mean, maybe you could argue that maybe the Germans are genetically predisposed to thinking about engineering and chemistry and things like that. But there's also, once you're developing a culture, a scientific culture within a discipline, is a more delicate thing than I think we realize. You know, that expertise really gets.
Well, we also have to remember that the Germans accept homeopathy far more than Americans.
And that's another cultural phenomenon, because homeopathy was very popular in Europe. And, the royal family in England, endorse homeopathy. Which, of course, segues into number four on your What's New list, which is a topic we discussed before. A recent article, I'll just read the text here. A study at the University of Bern reported in Lancet compared 110 trials, each of homeopathy and conventional medicine, and found that the benefits attributed to homeopathy were merely placebo effects. This is a great analysis. This endorsed essentially what I've been saying and what other critics have been saying about the previous meta-analyses of homeopathic trials. Essentially that the smaller, weaker, poorly designed studies, were all over the map. Some showed benefit, some didn't show benefit. But the better the study, the smaller the size of the effect that was measured. And the best studies, the ones that were really carefully controlled, showed no effect.
Well, that's true of a
absolutely
lot of paranormal studies.
The better the quality of the study, the smaller the effect. And they, just as a control, which is what the new bit, I think, that they did that no one else has done before, is they did this. They applied their methods to more standard pharmaceuticals to see if the same pattern holds up, and it didn't. In the definitive studies, pharmaceuticals did better than placebo, but homeopathy did no better than placebo. So that, again, this was reported on your site, and I think that is a great study, because it not only it teaches us how to think about a look at the literature, which I think is the big problem with alternative medicine. Have you dealt with that topic much, alternative medicine?
Oh, yes. And I've got a chapter on it in my book. But in fact, was busy writing a book on the subject when I got distracted writing on different subjects. So, but I'll go back to that. I will write that book yet.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. I mean, it's my specialty within the area of skepticism. I'm a physician, as well as a skeptic, and I've read most of my articles on that topic.
Well, I actually serve on a steering committee for the NIH Center of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and which most scientists, myself included, fought very bitterly when Congress imposed that on NIH. But in recent years, I think people have got to look back and recognize what a change has taken place. The real change took place when they put a genuine scientist in as the
You're talking about Stephen Strauss?
When it was just a That's correct. Strauss he's a serious scientist, and he has approached this thing in a way that is a little frustrating for some of us. That is, when anybody comes to him with a suggestion that would sound to us as just totally preposterous, his reaction is, well, that is certainly interesting. We should do a double-blind study of that. And though that seems a little wasteful, almost, these are not inexpensive studies, the fact is it had gone so far that I think this is about the only way to turn it around.
Yeah.
And so far, each of these double-blind studies that's been initiated since he took over, many of these studies were already underway before he got there, But all of them that have taken place since have found essentially no effect. I think that's a little, in fact, worrying to some people. I think that we're really hoping to find at least one alternative therapy that would be helpful. And the place they would look, of course, is in herbal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
All of modern pharmacology is based on herbal medicine. And so they, even within herbal medicine, they looked around to find the herbal treatment that most
likely
popular,
to work, in their opinion.
Most likely to work. And they latched on to echinacea. And of course, they found no effect at all.
They took the most plausible end of the alternative medicine spectrum and decided to rack up an early victory by studying that, and that was dead negative.
So, Bob, does that mean they really should stop at that point and start working on other things, or should the effort continue to really try to find some scientific evidence to these alternative claims?
Well, I don't know, and I don't really know quite what the plan is at this point, but certainly the steering committee advised that this was one of the things they should be looking at. This steering committee, among the things that they said they should not waste any time on at all, is homeopathy.
That's interesting, but this is a very interesting discussion among, you know, physicians who are in favor of scientific medicine or critical of anti-scientific or alternative medicine. Well, that's kind of a difficult category to wrap your mind around, because it doesn't really have an easy definition. But in any case, so the criticism of the Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine and putting millions of dollars into researching these things are a few. One is that this is diverting funds from other things which have more plausibility and are more likely to help the public. The second is that even if you say, a point which I agree with, that treatments which are already broadly used and accepted, even if they don't have plausibility or even if they probably don't work, we need to study it so that the public has that information. But the criticism of that is the history has shown that scientific studies which prove that these modalities don't work doesn't really affect the sellers, the users, you know, the practitioners of these studies. People are going to still sell echinacea. You know, the study showed that St. John's wort didn't work. It's still on the market. There have been study after study showing that chiropractic manipulation doesn't, you know, work for ear infections or for other things. Chiropractors continue to do what they do.
Asthma.
So if the practitioners are not basing their therapies on scientific evidence, what's the point in proving to them scientifically that what they're doing doesn't work? What would you say to that?
Well, I understand the argument. However, you know, where are you going to start? And I think these things simply have to be done. One thing that you worry about is that the public simply takes away the memory that NIH worked on this.
Mm-hmm.
And it winds up adding a little plausibility.
That's in fact another criticism, is that the practitioners are often advertise the fact that this treatment that they're giving is under serious scientific study. That becomes a marketing point, a selling point.
Right.
Exactly.
And then the results, no matter what they are, they sell them as either a negative study is, well, this is encouraging and requires further research. And anything that can possibly be interpreted as positive, of course, is total confirmation.
Well, it's like the evolution debate in Kansas. They didn't want to send any evolutionists over there to give it credence. And just by showing up and debating it, know, you give the other side a certain amount of credibility, and you have to make that decision. Do we want to give them that credibility? And I think the jury's still out on whether that was a good move.
I've not been entirely comfortable with that particular one.
Let me change topic here. In light of the havoc that the Hurricane Katrina has wreaked on New Orleans and the Mississippi coast, a lot of people have been asking about the possibility of weather control. What do you think about the prospects of this even going into the distant future, 100 or 200 years from now?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that it's conceivable. There have been a lot of proposals in the past, and sodium iodide crystals, all of these things that never quite worked, and cloud seeding of all sorts. Whether we can, in fact, actually manipulate weather, I don't see any reason why we can't eventually. But that's one of the things that troubles me, is we've got to start thinking more about what we do to take care of this planet.
Well, there certainly are people who are dedicated to weather modification. I mean, there's societies, and they have conferences and everything. You know, people trying to promote this. It's very underfunded right now. I've heard several reports. I have some family down in New Orleans, so I've been watching this very closely, and I've heard several people over the last few days begin to blame what happened and what is happening on global warming. Do you see any connection yourself?
Well, I think that's possible, and so we may have been running a big experiment, mm-hmm. not knowing it.
Yeah.
But I certainly think it's possible. A hurricane draws its energy from the water temperature, and the water temperature in the Gulf this year is the highest I think that it has been. And so there are questions of, you know, is this because of
Do you think global warming in general? Do you think that the theory is sound?
I think we're to the point, right on the edge at least, of a consensus that there is global warming and that it is anthropogenic.
It certainly seems where the evidence is building over time, and I think that the other side, those that are claiming that there is no global warming, are starting to lose traction and starting to take on the role of deniers rather than, you know, serious scientific discourse.
Well, and this is kind of exciting. I mean, we don't come to a big consensus like that easily in science. And I try to use this to my class as a very positive example of the way things are supposed to work. That, look, when this began, the scientific community was split right down the middle on the issue of global warming. Both sides believed they were right and determined that, you know, if we just do better research, we'll prevail because we are on the side of truth. Both sides thought that, and both sides knew that if they made a single mistake, the other side was going to pounce on it. The result was that both sides worked as hard as they could and were as careful as they could be. The result was that we made more progress in a decade than certainly in the all of previous history. It's a field that just burgeoned as a result of that.
And that's a good representation of the community effort that is modern science, again, as opposed to the classic, you know, centuries ago view of the lone scientist, you know, laboring away in their basement. And that controversy and discussion and uncertainty, et cetera, drives better research, better information, and we lead to, you know, again, more information, better answers, ultimately building towards, as you say, a consensus. And again, I think that the idea of the consensus of scientific opinion is something that we take for granted and we certainly respect, whereas the media, and by extension the public at large, tends to think of scientific authority as residing in an individual scientist and not really recognizing the fact that individual scientists could be total wackos. They could be far, you know, off the mainstream, and there's really no reason to put any faith or reliability in the opinions of an individual. But when you have hundreds of individuals hashing it out, a consensus is likely, and a consensus emerges from that process. I think historically those consensuses have been pretty reliable.
Well, they have, but that they, on the other side of it, they will also at times argue that, well, what do you mean, that we're going to decide
right.
the truth by taking a vote? And of course, it's not a matter of taking a vote at all.
There's a reason for the consensus. The consensus evolves out of the evidence and logic. It's not democracy. It's not
exactly.
a popularity contest, and it's not an argument from authority. There's a process, a method behind the consensus. That's something I really almost constantly struggle with when discussing these types of bigger issues with the public. The one that I'm taking on head on right now is the question of whether or not vaccines have caused an autism epidemic. And there, the research is really thorny. But basically, it's evolving towards a pretty firm consensus that at the present, you know, after a number of reasonably good studies, there's no evidence that there's any correlation between vaccines and autism, and in fact there might not even be an autism epidemic. But when you talk to these people about the consensus of scientific opinion, they see conspiracies and arguments from authority, and you know, they think that because you know they can look at the literature on the internet that they have just as much of a right to a scientific opinion as anybody else, and it should carry as much weight and respect as the consensus of scientists who have dedicated their careers to thinking about these things.
Well, they do have a right to their opinion, but that doesn't make their opinion right.
But what, we shouldn't base public policy on some guy's opinion, but...
We certainly shouldn't, but a consensus is in a field like this is
right.
a rare and wonderful thing, and I think it's terrific to watch. So I've enjoyed watching the arguments over climate science, and I think we've made just enormous progress as a result of it.
Evan, you were going to bring up a question?
Yeah, well, just as I was, of course, strolling around the Internet, I came across something attributed to you, Bob, that you're a leading critic of manned missions into space, which I was kind of actually a little bit surprised to see. Maybe you can elaborate on that for us.
Well, I don't think it's unusual for physicists to be skeptical of manned space exploration, and I've testified before Congress on it several times, and I've been on the Lehrer News Hour talking about it. I almost get concerned that I've become mm-hmm. the token critic, and don't enjoy that role particularly. But look, if we go back to the beginning of the space age, which began with the Soviet Sputnik, at that time, our reason for really going into it as fully as we did was the Cold War. It was Cold War competition. It was an attempt to prove that a free people can do anything that a dictatorship
right.
can do and do it better.
Sure.
And we had no thought of sending people into space. And in fact, there was a long study done, a president of MIT headed it, done for Eisenhower, which said, look, there's no point in putting people in space. We can send instruments in space, and instruments will send the information back at the speed of light and do it for a tiny fraction of the cost of sending humans. But when the Soviets put a human in space, Kennedy, whose real talent was to see the deeper aspirations mm-hmm. of the public, immediately recognized that, you know, this is where the contest is right now. And so we put human beings into space and went on to the moon as part of the Cold War competition. And we won, hands down. But
did you agree with
that?
Do you agree with that, Bob? Should we have done that?
In the context of the Cold War, yes, I think we should have done it. And we did it well.
Yet you're saying
that
there's no...
The Cold War is over.
There's no context to... No context today for the justification of sending one of our astronauts to Mars.
Well, they've been trying to drum up a competition between the United States and China, but that's almost humorous.
Well, there's also Carl Sagan's argument which and he thinks that we should, you know, he thought rather that we should not do it purely out of competition, Cold War or otherwise, but that putting robots and machines into space is a great efficient way to conduct exploration and to basically pave the way into space. But there's a certain romantic aspect to space exploration, and it's that aspect which captures the human imagination, which captures our spirit for exploration. And doing that is important to maintaining public, long-term, sustained, you know, public support for a space program, which is something that robots won't achieve, no matter how nice the pictures they send back are. So what would you say to that argument?
Well, in fact, that is exactly the internal belief within NASA. They're absolutely convinced that no humans, no space program.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of disagree with that. Look, these are a new bunch of kids out there. These are cyber kids. They don't know the difference.
Right, it's a good point.
they've been playing video games for so long that you know, they understand sending a robot perfectly well. So I it's never been tested, and I'm not so sure that that we really have to put humans
right
out there to get public support.
Well,
the
Steve,
number
look
of hits on the NASA website when they when Little Sojourner was rambling around on the surface of Mars hit an all-time record. Never hit anything like that for the man program.
I remember that.
Bob, you were saying?
Exactly what he just said. I was going to make that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, having a virtual presence in space may be as natural to the next generation as the romantic idea of having astronauts or people up in space as to our generation. And so this...
Well, let me try another one on you, and that is, where else are we going to go? I mean, are we doing all this just to go to Mars? You know, if we had found life on Mars, maybe that'd be worth it, and we certainly ought to keep looking.
What do you think about the idea that, you know, eventually colonizing other worlds would be a good thing for humanity and may actually even increase the longevity of our species by making us not dependent on one world, which could be, you know, wiped out by an asteroid impact or some disaster like that?
I don't understand this one at all. In the first place, the idea of colonizing Mars, you know, let's colonize Antarctica first. It's a Garden of Eden compared to Mars.
Right.
But way beyond that, this is a huge endeavor. If Mars is as far as we can go, and it pretty much is, at least for the foreseeable future, any other destination for human beings in the solar system is going to take us too long to get there, or the gravity is so great that it will crush a human, or the radiation levels are so high that you couldn't possibly survive.
Right.
So that's the end of the line. To put all of this effort into going to the planet that we're right now, you know, we've got two guys rambling around on the surface of Mars that never break for lunch. They don't complain about the cold nights, and they live on sunshine.
Well, that has been it's been an incredible mission.
It truly is.
It's lasted much longer than they even dreamed it would to this point.
Yeah, we're way past the design lifetime of these robots, yes. I try to emphasize that these are not robots in the old sense of science fiction. These are not autonomous. They're really just extensions of somebody comfortably seated in Houston.
With a big time delay.
With a big time delay. That's a larger software problem.
Right.
But it's certainly real. But you know, they say, well, one of the arguments that's often given to me is, well, you know, they can react, a human could react in an emergency. Well, what kind of an emergency? Well, you know, if a boulder comes rolling down at them, well, my goodness, I don't see much happening on Mars. things look like the
most emergencies would involve the risk to the people themselves.
Well, that's
right.
They
could save themselves if there's an emergency. But they wouldn't be there in the first place.
So, and besides which, you know, one of the great arguments made for the space program is spin-offs. Now, it's mostly fabricated.
Really?
There are three kinds of liars in the world. There are ordinary liars, damned liars, and spin-off claimers. the spin-offs that were claimed for NASA, and most people are not aware of this, there was actually a study done of this for Dan Golden when he took over as administrator of NASA, which has never been made public, and was presented to him in the form of an oral presentation. But what survived are the view graphs and a little bit of text that goes between them. And the conclusion was that none of the spin-offs were really spin-offs, that they were all things that industry did first, but they found that there was huge advertising potential to claiming they did it
as a space technology,
part of the space
age
program.
Technology. Yeah, that was certainly the that was the buzz phrase.
Exactly,
of course, the Apollo missions.
And NASA went along with this because they could then sell it to Congress as, look what we turned out with your dollars.
Duct tape didn't come from NASA? Didn't come from the space program? That's the one I always hear about.
Or Tang.
Duct tape?
Which one are we talking about?
Duct tape.
Oh, no. Nor did Tang, nor did Velcro, nor did Teflon, nor any of those.
What about the pens that write upside down?
Wow.
I thought NASA spent millions of dollars developing those.
Yes, and the Russians solved it with a pencil.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
Awesome.
So, Bob, you've been doing this for quite some time now, writing your column and investigating voodoo science, as you call it. What do you think is the most outrageous, egregious, unscientific claim or thing that you've ever heard?
Gee, wow.
That's a tough one.
That's a
tough
big
one.
Question. Yeah. Top three.
But certainly... The one that I think that has caused the greatest amount of grief in the world is extrasensory perception.
Really? In what way?
Once you believe that, you can believe anything.
See, that's a gateway. That's a gateway belief to the paranormal.
Exactly.
That's interesting. It is. It is
ubiquitous. I mean, I would guess 70% of people. Believe in some form of extrasensory perception. It's such a common belief that people don't realize, you know, they don't really look into it and realize that there is, not only is there no evidence, but the mechanism by which it would work it doesn't have anything to it, you know. It's just, on both counts, it's dead.
And worse than that, if it would work, it would be total turmoil.
Right. It's a good thing that it doesn't work.
The evidence would be right in our faces.
I know. I always remind people that our federal government spent, I believe, $20 million trying to get it to work and ultimately concluded that it was of absolutely no value.
Well, listen to this. I just recently read something very interesting about that, that the government sometimes will say that they've spent, or maybe they will spend, a few million dollars on something completely bogus. And part of the intention, apparently, is to have other governments say, oh, look what they're doing. We got to start spending millions of dollars on this too. And, you know, so it's an attempt by our government to actually, you know, make other governments waste their money.
On dead ends.
On dead ends, things that we know as dead ends. So I'd like to believe that might be true. I'd like to
I think it backfired.
they wouldn't come out and say that it failed. And then they would try to string along the possibility that it was some value to it. But... after $20 million were flushed, they said this is absolutely worthless. And specifically
right.
What they were studying was remote viewing. Essentially, they wanted to have psychic spies, you know, able to, you know, peek in the Kremlin or wherever they wanted to in the world psychically. But it didn't work out for them.
Well, in fact, there's some evidence that they're still spending some money on that.
Yeah, I've heard that. I think the program was officially shut down, but I think individuals still might wheedle some money out of the government here and there for individual projects.
The guys who used to work on Project Blue Book, maybe?
Right.
Something else to do.
Did you have, since Perry brings it up, have you ever had any involvement with the UFO culture?
Well, a little bit. And I in my book, I wrote a chapter about that. I had my own UFO experience.
Really? Let's hear it.
And, well, I was at the time stationed in Roswell, New Mexico.
The Mecca.
And exactly. This was after the famous Roswell episode, but not long after, just a few years. And UFOs were a very big thing then, and there were reports constantly of unidentified flying objects. And one weekend, I drove home to visit my family, and in South Texas, and to get there, I had to drive through a very desolate region of West Texas. And I was returning from that trip, and all of a sudden I had a white Oldsmobile back then, and that Oldsmobile just lit up with light from the sky, and it was a kind of a greenish light, and I looked up in the sky, and there was this brilliant blue-green light flashing across the sky. And finally it passed behind a range of low hills off in the distance and would flash on and off as it passed behind those hills and then vanished with no sound whatever.
Interesting.
And now I thought at the time, you know, that would have gone down as a UFO had I not known what it was, and I was pretty sure I did know. That that blue-green light is characteristic of the recombination of the hydroxyl radical, and what I was seeing was an ice meteorite.
An ice meteorite?
It's not an ice meteorite. There are the meteorites of consisting largely of ice. When they warm up, passing through our upper atmosphere, I should back up a little. These meteorites, of course, are being bombarded by cosmic rays all the time. But they're at such low temperature that when it breaks water molecules into its the hydroxyl radical, the radical doesn't recombine because it's simply too cold. But as it starts to warm up, you start getting the recombination of all these hydroxyl radicals with the extra hydrogen, and this gives off this blue-green glow, and so the mechanism for this is, you know, is known, and other people have seen.
Right. So this is a known phenomenon.
And, so it's a known phenomenon. So I said, aha, you know, it's a good thing I knew something about this, or I would really have been disturbed. And about that time, again, driving down this desolate stretch of highway, I saw a flying saucer. And it was flying parallel just over the desert, traveling right beside my automobile. Well, a ways off. I couldn't tell how far. And I was so startled that the first thing I did was accelerate, and this thing speeded up, too, and I thought it was following me. And only seconds had passed here, and I slammed on the brakes, and it stopped, and then I saw what it was.
Was it the moon?
It was
Venus.
It was my headlights.
It was your headlights.
Reflecting off of a single phone line strung parallel to the highway.
I see. Oh, okay.
Wow.
And it looked like a disc from the edge. But my brain filled in all the rest.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Now, of course, if you were a drunken farmer from Nebraska and not a physics professor from Maryland, that story would have entered into the UFO lore as an unexplainable encounter with an extraterrestrial phenomenon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I try to remember that whenever I get annoyed at UFO claims, and
right.
I often
right.
do,
they are annoying, right.
that for a few seconds I believed in UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, after doing this for the number of years that we have, you become familiar with the personality of the different types of believers. You know, and I do think that UFO believers have a certain personality type. And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I think that they are the craziest bunch in the spectrum of paranormal believers. It attracts a certain personality, a certain kind of paranoid, conspiracy-minded, really out there, crazy personality. And the conversations I've had with believers of all stripes, they are an order of magnitude farther out there than anyone else I've spoken to. I don't know if you've had similar experiences.
Well, I've argued that believers, in fact, are a sort of a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps they have a secret handshake by which they recognize one another. But you would be amazed at how many cold fusion believers believe in UFOs.
Oh, absolutely. I agree that there's a certain there's a lot of overlap there, and I think there's a lot of overlap in personality as well.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe they use ESP to communicate, Bob.
ESPs, well, belief in ESP is common. Perry and I went to this New Haven UFO convention and made a similar observation that at this UFO convention there were also books on Bigfoot and ESP and other phenomenon as well. And one might ask, well, if aliens are visiting the Earth, why does that mean that Bigfoot exists or that we have the ability to have ESP? Why would, these beliefs go together, as a suite.
Well, of course, it's the believer
that's in common. It's the believer.
I argue that there is a belief gene.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us have that gene and some of us don't.
You think it's that simple?
I'm only half
right.
Joking. I suspect that our ancestors living in a wilderness when we were hunter-gatherers, there may well have been an advantage. You know, the great advantage of human beings over other animals was the ability to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it would not be surprising if what went along with that was a willingness to believe what you hear spoken.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody warns you that there is a tiger hiding in the tall grass, you'd do well to avoid the tall grass,
right,
whether there's
right.
a tiger there or not.
And some have argued that in general there probably was an evolutionary advantage to belief over skepticism, and that skepticism, in fact, may have been evolutionarily disadvantageous. And for example, the example that you just gave, along with that is perhaps the idea that human beings being essentially tribal in our evolutionary milieu, as they call it, there may have been an advantage to believing in the group or believing in, again, something greater than ourselves, and that may have conferred also an evolutionary advantage.
I think that's probably so, yeah.
But, again, it's a very interesting question. It's certainly something we wrestle with quite frequently. Why are there people like us, basically, who are predisposed to skepticism or like to analyze things in a very, rational manner? And then there are other people who, as hard as I try to explain, why I believe the way I do and things like logic and evidence, etc., they're completely just on a different plane. I try to dig down as deep as I can to any common ground to hold on to. And with some people, more towards the spiritual end of the spectrum, New Age, etc., I eventually discover that there's nothing left. There is no common ground. There's no fundamental principle of reality or thinking upon which that we can agree and then proceed from that point. That really they just have a different premise in terms of how they think about what's real and what's not real.
I don't know about you guys. I do it for the chicks.
Skeptics get all the chicks. That is the best kept secret.
Yeah. It must be. Only slightly more secretive is that they make the big money.
Right.
Big money and lots of women. Yeah.
So what's next for Bob Park? What projects are you working on now?
Well, as I say, I started out to write a book on alternative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
My agent was not at all wild about this idea. She says, "Look, you're not going to change the mind of the believers, and the rest of them won't be interested in your book. So the believers won't buy it because it'll infuriate them." But I plan to go back to that one.
Yeah,
I need to do that. But right now we're in the midst of a real sort of change going on here. The war between science and religion just broke out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes,
when the president made his announcement about intelligent design, that changed everything.
Yeah.
Now this is the war is official. And,
yeah, and in a way, I kind of liked that he finally let it all hang out and really announced what he believed publicly, because we all knew it, and he kind of alluded to it a lot in a lot of different places and times. But here, he just really just said it. Yeah, let's teach it right along with evolution, and you know, basically saying that it's put it in science class.
That's right, but it's a dangerous time. I mean, it could it could work out well, or it could work out very badly.
Right.
Well, what was good is that his
science. We could lose this war, basically.
Yeah, his science advisor though followed up shortly afterwards and said that he disagrees with respectfully disagrees with the president.
Well,
his opinion.
He advised the president then.
Well,
he advised all the rest of us, but why in the hell didn't he advise the president?
Apparently he did, and the president just decided not to follow that advice.
Well, I think that's what the president has done with all the advice he's given him, if he's given him any.
Apparently.
If I was the science advisor and nobody paid any attention to my advice, I think I'd find something else to do.
Interesting.
You know, mm-hmm. Politically, I support the president. Scientifically, he is a dead head. It's
really
very it's very serious.
And the rest of the, he's basically
very bad.
He's the symbol of America to the rest of the world. The rest of the world
sure.
thinks that Americans are scientifically illiterate, you know, barbarians almost. And you know, what better symbol for that caricature than George Bush?
Steve, what world leader is scientifically literate? I can't think of one.
Living?
Yeah.
Living?
Sure. No, really. I mean, seriously. Even Tony Blair. You know, his wife is very steeped into all the pseudosciences, and apparently it's rubbed off on him as well. But really, I can't think of a modern leader of a country that has a good understanding of science.
Kim Jong Il?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know.
There's no one. There's no one. They don't mix.
That's right.
There's
they don't.
No
politics and science that don't mix. You think that's it?
I mean, Bill Frist is a scientist, or he's a
No. He's a doctor.
He's an MD.
Which,
okay.
Well, as a matter of fact, of course, when Bill Frist first got into the Senate, he looked like he was going to be a real champion of science.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a S&T, a science and technology a forum within the Senate, and he headed that. And he pushed hard for increased funding for research. It was not until he began to get presidential aspirations that he found out that this isn't very useful.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
I think he's taking a lot of heat for it. I think, to some degree, it's all a bit transparent. For example, his reversal on the stem cell decision, you know, he basically initially supported the president in his stem cell position, and recently Bill Frist came out to say that he supports stem cell research. But most of the commentators I've read about that were pretty cynical and said, well, now he's just playing to the center a little bit to try to position himself for a presidential run, and no one bought it, basically, that it was sincere. So I don't know how well it's working for him.
The analysts that I heard on that subject, their explanation was, look, he's got to separate himself from the president.
Mm-hmm.
And show that he's his own man, and he thinks for himself.
Right.
And so that was a very calculated move.
Yes.
But then he, in addition to that calculated move, he can also count votes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot more born-again Christians out there than there are skeptics.
Right. And it's absolutely true. And, you know, stem cell research still is supported by a majority of Americans. So the president is actually in the minority in this one. So far, Frist is coming down on the side, the popular side of all these decisions. He has yet to take a decidedly unpopular position because he believes in it. And I think that's, you know, not to get, we don't be trying to get too overtly political on the show. We try to remain scientific. But I think, you know, what these issues show is that Frist is... a character who, a politician who bases his popularity on supporting his base, as it were, rather than on the courage of his convictions. And I think, again, that's what the analysts are saying. This is a calculating move to play to voters, not to support what he really believes. Which, you know, again, comes back to the point I think we made earlier that politics and science don't mix. That you're best off letting science do what it does. At best, science should inform the political process, but politics should not inform the scientific process.
Wasn't there a time though, 200 years ago, when they sort of did mix? You know, the Benjamin Franklins of the world and so forth. There were, you know, the John Adams. These were people who really had a good understanding of science and, you know, managed to find a country in the process.
The founding fathers were children of the Enlightenment, no question.
Look, this was before the huge revolution in science really got underway.
Right. It wasn't institutionalized.
It hadn't quite started yet.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's almost started with Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, certainly does seem to be the consensus.
Yeah, I think the big difference is that science is now institutionalized. It's no longer the activity of just lone gentleman researchers. It's a multi-billion dollar industry and institution, and which is a good thing because it enables it the engine of scientific change, you know, to grind very, very quickly and to command a tremendous amount of resources. And that's where I think the politics comes in, because whenever you have huge amounts of resources involved, it's politicians who decide how those resources get spent. The best we could hope for is that our politicians are enlightened enough to at least listen to their science advisors. But if that's not going to be the case, then, you know, we end up with things like the president endorsing public schools teaching pseudoscience as science.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you said enlightened, because that's, whatever happened to the Enlightenment? I mean,
right.
Why can't we have that again?
We need a new Enlightenment, a second Enlightenment. It does seem, you know, I try not to be a Cassandra or to be mired in sort of short-term, you know, view of trends. Certainly being a skeptic, you know, at the turn of the millennium, it seems like we are mired in a resurgence of pseudoscience and superstition and spirituality. Although I know that if you look at the sort of long course of history, science is still pretty much relentlessly marching forward and increasing in public support and popularity. And, you know, religion, the role of religion and spirituality in civilization, in society, is still pretty much on the wane. I think that perhaps this maybe is just a short-term fluctuation, but we'll see. It's hard to sort of lift yourself out of your time and see the big picture.
Give it time. I think science will out in the end. I think so.
I hope so.
I agree. I mean, I think the one thing that science as a process has on its side is that it's the one thing that works, and no other sort of human attempt at figuring things out or having any kind of system of knowledge has in fact worked. And in the end, it can't help, I think, but to succeed, I think, against... As long as it's allowed in the game. Of course, historically, there have been times when, free inquiry or scientific endeavors have been crushed. You know, the Dark Ages, essentially, you know, 2,000 years of essentially absence of scientific thinking was ushered in by the destruction of... sort of the birth of science in ancient Greece. You know, I do wonder, and I don't know what you think about this, Bob, is it possible to extinguish the light of science in our culture, or to to knock it down so much that we may set back the cause of, you know, human exploration and advancement significantly by decades or centuries. Do you think that's even possible at this point?
Not for that long a period, but certainly in the short term, it can cause us an awful lot of grief.
Absolutely.
And I think we're perilously close to that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. I think, which kind of, in a way, kind of makes it exciting to be doing what we're doing. You know, I think we're certainly fighting the good fight, and we try to get right down there in the trenches. And I certainly enjoy the company in these trenches better than the other ones. I think it's certainly been a privilege and a pleasure to talk with people like you, like Bob Park, like, you know, Michael Shermer and Massimo Pellucci and the other people we've had on this show. I think the intellectuals, the enlightened ones of our age, are on this side of the coin, on this side of the equation. Well, any parting thoughts before we close the show?
I thought that was a good last line.
That was a good last line. You like that?
I thought so, too.
Well, listen, Bob, we really appreciate you being on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This has
been a
great show.
You're
we appreciate
welcome.
It. We look forward to continuing to visit your website. Again, that's bobpark.com, and looking at your In the News section.
Well, you know, that website is just not kept up.
Oh, it's not?
I'm sorry. I've really not kept that website up.
Well, the In the News section looks pretty updated. Is that what you focus on?
Yeah. It's all really pretty old, and I just haven't the time to bother with it. My son actually put it together for me.
Oh, really?
And he's now too busy as well. So I need to get a student or somebody to spend some time on it. But I have another website, which is bobpark.org.
Okay.
And that's where you really find my column.
That's where your column is, bobpark.org. Great.
Right, and which is now supported by the University of Maryland.
Right.
It's sponsored by the University of Maryland, and they keep it up for me. You know, it has a good search engine with it, and the search engine alone, I think, when you see an issue, and I try to urge people when they see an issue that interests them in what's new, to immediately go to the search engine and type in the keywords and see what's been said about it before.
Well, it's a good resource. We'll keep it on our link list. Thanks again, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks again for joining us on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information on this and other episodes, see our website at www.thenes.com.